This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Holly Karapetkova is here, and she'll tell you who she is by what she writes. And here's a poem from Holly.
Thank you, Grace. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Me too.
Yeah, I've been a fan of yours for a long time.
Me too.
I'm going to start with the poem that's the opening poem for my forthcoming collection. It's coming out early in 2025. And this is called Genesis. Like any mother, I lived for my children. Bone of my bones, gave them my body as house, gave them my house as home. I was fruitful. I multiplied. Nothing was ever my own, and I called this sacrifice, devotion. What I called them became their names. Some grew and some did not. Some were angry and some were not. Some murdered, some tended the flocks, some built boats to escape the flood. Some built towers into the sky. Some became pillars of salt. I fed them by the sweat of my brow. Some needed more than I could give them, though I saved only thorns and thistles for myself. God was a voice in the sky with no tree to burn. God was a shower of sulfur, a snake winding through the dirt. If I had a moment to spare, I might have bent to hear what he was saying.
Holly, you are so good. No one sounds like you. No one. You were once Poet Laureate of Arlington County, Virginia, and you
Correct.
Received this fabulous fellowship from the Academy of American Poets. What did you do with that? What did you do with it?
It was such an amazing opportunity. I can't tell you how grateful I am to the Academy of American Poets with funding from the Carnegie Foundation. They fund this amazing Poet Laureates Fellowship. They give around 20, 22 fellowships every year to Poets Laureate across the country to do projects in their communities. And also, it also supports their own work. So with the fellowship, I was able to buy myself some time to finish the collection that's coming out now. But the big project that I was working on was this beautiful anthology of high school students. Yeah, and the cover is designed by, it's an art from an Arlington high school student.
Oh!
Correct, it's beautiful.
Give us a sample of it. How did you gather the submissions, and how did you organize it, and how long did it take?
So it was a real labor of love. I love working with young people. I'm a college professor, and I've chosen to spend my life working with young people and poetry. And so it was such a gift to be able to do this project. And I spent several months going into Arlington high schools. I did some workshops, really promoting the anthology and spreading the word. I was lucky that my son was in high school at the time. And so I had him and his English teacher as a contact. And I had some teachers in other Arlington high schools, because a lot of people ask me, how do you organize work with high school students?
And, yes.
And it's through the teachers. So I had some wonderful teacher contacts in all of the major Arlington high schools and was able to go into the schools and talk with young people. I also, a big help in this project were the youth laureates. So part of the collection was edited by Amasa Maleski and Kashvi Romani and Leah Mason. All of them are youth laureates or youth poetry ambassadors. Mm-hmm. Through another wonderful examination called Words Beats Life. And amazing work. And these kids are just, they're out there in the community promoting poetry, doing amazing things. And so I had their help promoting the anthology and help from teachers. And I was able to just collect some wonderful, wonderful work.
We're going to hear a couple, I hope.
You are. One more thing I want to say is that thanks to the fellowship from the Academy of American Poets, I was able to pay everyone. Every poet who was in the anthology was paid, and the youth editors were paid. I did this project with Day 8, awesome local organization, that does a lot of grassroots poetry organizing in the DC area. So they got paid. So because of this amazing fellowship, there was actually money for poetry.
What and a concept.
I know. I didn't want to tell these young people. I'm like, you may never get paid for writing a poem again.
But that is, but, you have done something. Don't get people eager.
I know.
But that is so inspiring, because people think poets are living on Mount Olympus, which we are, but there is a quality of engagement. Poetry has a very practical element.
Absolutely.
And would you talk just one more sentence about how engagement applies to your project? That very spiritual principle.
Yes, absolutely. And it was amazing to see all of these young people who write poetry for themselves. They're not doing it for school. They're writing totally different kinds of work than what they're reading in their classrooms. And they're speaking their truth. They're saying what they need to say for themselves, for their peers. And it was such a powerful experience to see these young people engaging with poetry. And, you know, and anytime somebody says, well, poetry is a dying art, I beg to differ, because it is alive and well in our communities.
I beg to differ. Here, give us a sample of poem two.
So I'm going to read this poem by Reeb Podesta. There's so many wonderful poems in this anthology, but I love this poem because it's about writing, and it talks about what writing means to her. And it's called Writing. I love writing poems about things I've never experienced. Deaths in the family, messy breakups, weddings. In my experience, years of exploration and serenading the irrational, literary voices in my head, I most love poems I have no reason to. I think that poetry pulls back my iron curtain, describing in dirty detail all of the deconstruction. I think the poets speak in colors, address me in a way that lets none of me be transparent. Perhaps poetry is a poison oak language, itching into the truth, healing better than plain English ever will. I wrote my best friend a poem on botany so that she'd know I am her garden. I wrote poems for the little woman that died and not the three sisters that moved on from it. Sometimes I write long, bitter monologues about my mother when I'm tired of the echolocation we do in bright, white rooms. She wouldn't understand it anyways. The dancing between the lines, the desperate references. In sixth grade English, I learned that the best poems show and not tell. So I'd crumble the black back of the receipt I write my thank you notes to her on. I'd show her how even when you unfold it, it just never goes back to the way it was. Present to her the eraser stains and faded ink. I wouldn't tell her anything at all. I just hope she can read between the thin blue tightropes. I write about you. I write for you.
Holly. Oh my goodness. Literary voices in my head. Dancing between the lines. How old is this person?
She's in college now. She was a youth laureate of Arlington, I think last year, 2023.
That is very, could you have written that in high school? I certainly
no.
I could never have thought so imagistically.
I know.
So originally, I think I was just an apprentice to everyone else when I was younger. That gives me chills. That is so excellent. What is her name again?
Reeb Podesta.
I don't know her, but I want to.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Well, this is showing what engagement means. It means giving everybody a leg up.
Absolutely.
Do you think that she has a whole bunch of a self-esteem from this anthology?
I think a lot of the kids did. You know, it was not something they had ever experienced before. And I was so proud of them. Not only did they agree to publish their poems, but most of them showed up to read. We did two readings, one at Washington Liberty High School and one at the Arlington Central Library. And we had, you know, dozens of kids show up to read their poems.
Were you still teaching the entire time you were poet laureate?
Yes, mm-hmm. I was. I had, because of the fellowship from the Academy of American Poets, I was able to have a course release, so I was able to teach less. So I had a little bit of a reduced workload, so that gave me more time to spend with the project.
Well, let's have a Holly poem.
Okay. I'm going to go back to my new collection and read a poem. I think it's a lighter poem.
I want everyone to know that you're a professor of, let's see, is English and Comparative Literature at Marymount in Virginia.
Just English. I teach, Marymount is a small school, so I teach everything, which is really fun.
Oh.
Yes. Everything from freshman composition up through senior seminar. I've taught it all. I taught graduate students while we had a graduate program.
Holly Karapetmetova.
And this poem is called Bad Parenting. And I have to say, I'm not like a habitual smoker, but when my children were young, my husband traveled a lot and I found myself single parenting on fairly frequently. And I had a pack of cigarettes that I kept stashed away.
One pack?
Yeah, well, okay, maybe more. But for those really desperate moments, and this is about one of those desperate moments, it's called Bad Parenting. Out back, smoking a cigarette below the window where no one can find me. The children are calling, Mommy, where are you? But when are they not asking for me? In the cold, my breath rises like smoke, even when I don't take a drag. The children are beginning to worry. The 7-year-old yells louder. The 2-year-old starts to cry. It's only a matter of minutes before they think to look for me here, but I need every minute I can get to figure out what happened to my life, sort through the details of this accident, the fur still lodged in white bumper paint, and the sound of muscle meeting metal, then dashing off into the night.
Holly, I keep looking at you and I've always thought of you as a teenager. I don't know why. I guess it's because you're the age of my children. But do you have children? I know you have a son in high school.
Yes, he's actually in college now.
Really?
I have a daughter who's now in high school. So this is from when they were very little. But parenting is fascinating.
It is so perfect because each of us, as perfect as we were, is filled with regret.
Yes.
We will never escape the littlest thing we did. And I still dream of it. So, but I've made a fortune out of it. Regret.
Right.
It's the mother's mantra, isn't it?
It is. It's always guilt. I have a number of poems. It's the mother is always to blame. Right.
Whatever. I love that. That's why I jive with you so much. Now you have won yet one more publication award. And yes. This is your third book coming out. Right. And what is the book and how does it compare with book one and two?
Yeah, it's a really different book for me. It's called Dear Empire. And it won the Barry Spax Poetry Prize from Gunpowder Press. And I'm so grateful for Gunpowder Press for believing in this book because it's a difficult book.
Mm.
And I had a harder time putting this collection together and then finding a publisher because it contains a lot of poems around white supremacy and a critique of white supremacy. And there've been a number of situations where white writers have attempted to write about race and really bombed it. And so I think there's a suspicion, a healthy suspicion when a white writer picks up the subject of race and racism.
Well, we want to hear some of it, but before that we have to have a station break so everyone can know what else you've written. Okay. So you've had two books of poetry before this. Words We Might One Day Say, which won the Washington Writers Publishing House Poetry Award. And Towline, winner of the Vern Rutsala Poetry Contest. The third book, Dear Empire, co-winner of the Barry Spax Poetry Prize. Really, Holly, aren't you tired of all these awards? I mean, leave some for somebody else. Leave some for somebody else. But how wonderful, because it is just that litmus test, it is just that fabric they rub against you that says you are real. You're real. To win an award is not gratuitous. It isn't just to lie in bed with an idea. It is really to say, go on.
Yeah.
Go on. Let us hear from this fabulous book, and it is bursts with courage.
Thank you. I'm going to read a poem about where the experience comes from my childhood. I grew up in Atlanta in a very racially fraught time in the 80s and early 90s, and I was part of the busing system. So it was called M2M, minority to majority. You could go from a school where you were in a minority to a school where you were a majority. And of course, none of the white kids wanted to leave because we all lived in areas with plenty of resources and good schools. So it was a lot of the black children in the poor areas of Atlanta who wanted a good education. And the only way, the government told them the only way they could get that was by busing halfway across town to a majority white school. And it was in many ways a troubling experience because we were not, there was no education or curriculum supporting this kind of transfer of people. But on the other hand, it was an amazing opportunity because I got to be friends with kids I wouldn't have otherwise been able to be friends with. And I learned about things and I learned to see racism and to understand it as a problem from a very early age. But my neighborhood was still largely white. And so this is a poem about that experience. It's called Neighborhood Games. They arrived on long yellow buses from neighborhoods across town. The long list repeated daily in homeroom. Shawana, DeMont, Tayara, Valencia, names we never used. They sat at their own lunch table, formed their own game of tag at recess. We were German, Polish, Norwegian, Italian, Scottish, British, white. The unwritten rules we'd already learned by heart. At home, we ran the neighborhood, played capture the flag, tackle football, snowball wars, ollie ollie and Comfrey. A wilderness grew behind our houses, acres and acres untamed. We made a secret hideout, dug a hole that could hold several of us at a time. I remember the view from inside, earth reaching to my shoulders, a hole so deep we had to climb down in it to keep digging.
The arrow that wounds as it heals. That's what I would say about this book. You know, Camus says we are always saying telling the same story over and over. What do you think your story is? What is your story?
I think that's very true. I think, I've had a relatively placid life, but on the other hand, it's been fraught with conflict, like the sort of racial tensions that I grew up with, the religious tensions. The first poem that I read is very much about my tension with Christianity and with my religious upbringing. So I think I'm a very, very sensitive person. That's why I became a poet. So I think my story is very much about living through conflict. That may not be, you know, a large like global conflict, but conflicts within my
community. But when did you get the courage to let that dam break and just let it flow? Because this is a very powerful book, and you took no prisoners. This is we say coraggio in Italian, because it is really a very strong and difficult book, and very painful and very beautiful and very true. It must have been a lot to overcome to write it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long process. This book is over 10 years in the making. I've had a number of conversations with, you know, other poets and you know, especially like my friends of color, writer friends of color. And they're like, well, how are you're writing about whiteness without doing the typical whiny white thing of like, oh, it's so hard to be a white person. and I was like, well, I think those poems were probably there in the beginning. And I worked through that. Right.
Right. But there's something about you that allowed you to do this. I mean, not only elevated consciousness and a sense of decency, but a fearlessness that says, you know, nothing's at stake. I'm just going to do this because you let the chips fall where they may. And that is what Louise Glick has. You know, that is what I really, what is so, you can teach poetry. You just can't teach that.
Thank you. I love Louise Glück. Thank you for that comparison.
No, I have more to say about you. Let's have another poem.
Okay, I'm going to read this one. And this is based on a true story from my visit at Mount Vernon. It's called, Was He Good to His Slaves? On a Mount Vernon.
What a question.
What a question. The question hangs in the air of the new room by the mirror on the wall. The guide has heard it before, like cherry trees and wooden teeth. He explains the acts of resistance and attempts at escape without missing a beat. The tall looking glass, however, is original and was purchased from a French envoy's estate. We watch ourselves walk past it as we are told Washington must have watched himself dancing centuries ago. I imagine his reflection, father of a nation, mouth closed to hide his teeth, which were made not of wood, but of ivory, cow teeth, slave teeth. The teeth were paid for. The slaves were paid for. Property passed down with all of its issue and increase. Out on the lawn, the sun is setting low on the horizon. We squint our eyes against the light, shining us straight in the face. It's impossible to see ahead, though anyone coming from the other direction must see us clearly. All our colors lit.
I like very much about how you change point of view so many times in that poem. Let's hear another.
Great. So this poem is called Dear America. I called and no one answered. I left voice messages, sent texts and emails lost in the ether. Tell me things aren't as bad as they seem. Tell me that's not a bullwhip in your back pocket, smallpox on your hands, fossil fuels foaming between your teeth. Tell me when La Migra pounds on the door, when blue lights flash beneath an overpass, and drones swarm the sky like birds of prey. They leave no bodies behind. Tell me only the map is darkening, only the sun passing behind a cloud.
You know, I've read all of your poetry, and I know your work, and I know your books. And there has always been a feeling I had that you have some Charlie Simic in your blood.
Oh,
yes. And more, not, I can't exactly point it out in this book, but there are, I wonder if you agree, you have this minimal quality, this spare quality, this ironic attitude, this social consciousness, this offbeat look that is just not American. It's so European.
Thank you.
I wonder if it's from being married to a Bulgarian.
Yeah, I've had a lot of exposure. I've lived in Bulgaria and had a lot of exposure to Bulgarian culture. And
no, I was joking. I really didn't think that I could do it.
But
because your own childhood, you know, white from Atlanta, but you are so Charles Simic.
Thank you.
He would be proud to be alive and to read your work. So let's have another poem.
Okay. And this is called Without Sanctuary. And I did my first graduate degree in MFA at Georgia State University in Atlanta. And one of my classmates' uncle was a collector of lynching postcards and lynching memorabilia. And he collected it, obviously, you know, to remind us of our history. And he put it together in a website called Without Sanctuary that you can view. And it's postcards and photographs of lynching in America. And the title of the poem is Without Sanctuary. I turn to leave, but it is always sunset. The shadows stretch, each knuckle a knot, each tree a body shifting in the wind. In the postcard photograph, white faces crowd in to watch. I cannot see their features clearly enough to know I am not among them. On the back, a photo credit, a county and state, proof of witness. Sometimes a note, coon cooking, all okay, and would like to get a post from you. Then a scrawled signature, a name, an address. Strike a match. We all go up in smoke.
Whoa. You know, this book is more important than you know. It is not just poetry. It is an umbrella for America. And I wonder, would you consider sending it to Bryan Stevenson? You know, do you remember he started that museum? Is it Mississippi? The lynching museum? The
Yes, I know what you're talking
Mississippi.
About.
And you know who he is? The civil rights lawyer?
I do.
Started this. I think that he would appreciate the book, and I think you should mail it to him when it comes out.
I certainly
because
will.
People, yes, you'd be surprised. People are human. You know, it's not that he's just an icon. This speaks to all the work he's been doing, and it could even give him, you know, a burst of energy.
That's a wonderful idea.
It is. I assure you, I will help you find the address.
One of the things that you know strikes me when I look at those photos is the white that comes into the poem, the white crowds watching, and the sort of ways I think that I discovered over the course of this project that racism is really horrible for white people, as horrible for white people as it is for anyone, because it makes us into monsters. And I did a lot of primary source research, and I actually wrote a series of poems from the point of view of plantation mistresses, because I thought that was fascinating. What would that be like to be a woman in this situation? And one of the quotes that I remember that's like burned into my memory from this experience is a quote from the American Slave Project. So a former enslaved woman, and she said she remembers her master telling his young teenage sons to go down to the quarters and get him some more slaves. And I just imagine, like, you know, I have a young son. Like, what would that be like to be the mother raising your son to rape women in order to increase your property? And I just, like, you know.
Holly, it's a contribution. It is a contribution, but that it is in such prosody, it makes it double a contribution. I am chilled and thrilled if you can do those things at one time with your courage and your ability to say it. You know, I was watching that rerun of Wolf Hall on PBS, and mm-hmm. I happened to see that behead Anne Boleyn last night. And I feel the same way about all the people watching her.
Yeah.
Watching her as she was beheaded. All of those people in the crowd became monsters.
Absolutely.
And you have hit upon a thing I don't think I've really heard before about how not one thing can transform all of us.
Yeah.
And that is what we have to fight against. And that language can do it better than anything. And the one thing about poetry is it cannot be co-opted.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful thought. Yeah, I think often about Auden's quote, poetry makes nothing happen, and how untrue that is. And even Auden, you know,
That was not said seriously, I don't
yes,
think.
Yes, exactly. And I you know, I do a lot of work in the community. You know, I still with high school students, but also with like retired communities. And I'm often out talking about poetry and the power of poetry and what it can do, what it can give us.
I know that about you. And when you look at our political climate, and each party has appropriated the other, you know, well, there is no truth in language, because stop the steal, or I forget which one is saying which, because
yeah.
One party has appropriated the language of the other and turned it around.
Absolutely.
So that we have not language, but a prism, that words have become a prism. That's why poetry is inimitable. It is from the soul. It rinses off language. It does everything. It is not a good hobby.
That's
I mean,
true.
It is the very structure of civilization.
Yeah, that is true.
Once you lose language.
Yeah.
You've lost it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And we're in a really troubling, it's an interesting time. But you know, truth is no longer truth. You know, I have, you know, young people in my life. I know you do too, and you see sort of the ways that they distrust everything for a good reason. And
but they trust language.
Yeah,
that is the contribution we make as teachers.
Absolutely,
because if that's all we can do, really, is tell them the truth, how to really say who you are. Nobody Absolutely. Can imitate that. Nobody can. That is a thing. If we can just stay true to ourselves, something will be true anyway. Now,
yeah.
I know you translate poetry.
I do. Yeah.
In your spare, between 2 and 3 in the morning, right? While making
it's
stew, while making dessert.
translation feeds my own work. I mean the ability to step into someone else's voice and to sort of walk around in someone else's words for a little bit is such a gift, and it changes the way that then you write
That
and
I heard that, yeah.
world.
And that people say when you're getting to a dry place, translate a poem. And
Absolutely.
I can hardly, it's hard to believe though, truly, because it takes so much caloric output. Tell me why Bulgarian and how many you've published and
Yeah, so
translated.
my husband is Bulgarian, and I've lived in Bulgaria at certain points, and one of my first jobs after graduating from college was teaching English in Bulgaria. And yes, it was quite the experience. It was in the late 90s, and things, Bulgaria was out of the Iron Curtain, but things didn't work very well there, and I had to take trains all over the country, and sometimes the train just didn't come. And it was a fascinating, especially as a young person, a fascinating experience.
Are you brave?
I don't think of myself as that brave. I'm a little crazy, maybe.
Oh, there you go. Oh, crazy. That would get you from train to train.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
And I at a certain point I, learned the language. I did have a tutor. I kind of studied from a book for a little bit, but mostly I just learned being in the community, being surrounded by people. I joke that my husband was always talking about me after we met. He was always talking about me in Bulgarian, and I joke that I had to learn the language so he couldn't do that anymore.
Was it hard to learn? Are you one the kind of person who can just learn a language? I mean, your brain is wired that way.
Don't know. I mean, I don't. I learned Spanish in high school and don't really speak that. So I don't know if it's that or it's just I was around it so much that, and I loved the culture and I loved the people and I wanted to communicate. And also a lot of alcohol was involved. So that is
Isn't it
actually,
true about
it is.
European poets?
It, well, and it's very helpful for learning a language because it lowers your inhibitions and you're not afraid to try. Like you're not afraid to just talk to people. And I'm like an introvert, so like for me I think that was really helpful because I wasn't ashamed or afraid to try my horrible.
Now we know the secret to success.
The secret to success.
Well, read us a poem in English and Bulgarian.
Okay, I've just got the English here, so I'm just gonna read my Bulgarian is not, I don't know. I could read it in Bulgarian, but I'd probably maul it. So I'm just gonna read the English translation.
Okay.
But this is by a poet, Destena Angelova, who's a friend of mine, a beautiful writer and painter, and also somewhat involved with politics. She like narrowly missed being elected to the Bulgarian parliament, so that's really interesting. And this is called Three and Something Deaths, and I think you'll hear the painter in this poem. Three and Something Deaths. With what boredom the trees are blooming, besieged with green. All the leaves and branches are present. Salt drizzles from the loose knit of the sky, filling the gardens where death and winter loved to laze around. Naked dogs, their legs turning blue. Now it rains, but the souls of the trees are turning into ravens. Three and something deaths separate them from my childhood.
Yes, that is so Bulgarian. But when you translate, I understand that it's like writing a new poem.
It is. It is. It's very difficult because you have to make some cultural changes as well. It's you can't just literally plop one language into another.
Do you have a phraseology that matches the Bulgarian cadence, or doesn't that matter?
So I worry less. So Destena doesn't really write in form, so I worry less about capturing the form. I have worked with poets who do write in form, and that's a different kind of experience. You have to decide, do you value the form at the expense of the meaning and the original sort of intent, or do you drop some of the form and focus on
Oy vey.
And English just, we are not a rhyme-rich language, so, trying to bring something that rhymes in an original
Oh,
language.
that's interesting. Yeah. Now, I've seen poems of yours translated from Bulgarian or your translations, but have you ha had put a book out that I don't know about?
I collaborated with a friend of mine, Ivan Ivancheva. She wrote a book of poetry and prose that I translated. She wrote it in Bulgarian, and I translated it into English. And it was published in dual language version, but in Bulgaria. It was published in Bulgaria.
Oh, should we publish it here?
Well, that would be lovely. I know she would be delighted. I do have a full length collection of Desena's poems as well, that I've, been kind
that
of
have been published.
That no, happened? It's not published. But it's just a manuscript. But I, again, I've kind of been trying to publish it, but hasn't really been a huge focus of mine. But it's a beautiful book.
Well, things are really hot about translation now. And I know that Carolyn Forché is heading a project to be a bridge to European authors, which we need so badly.
Oh, absolutely.
And you have laid a cornerstone. Let us have a final poem by Holly Karapetkova.
Hey, I'm going to read a classic poem of mine from my second collection, Toe Line. And it's a poem that I wrote. My husband is actually, he's a political refugee as well as an immigrant. And many of my students are refugees of one kind or another. And I wrote this thinking a lot about the experience of one of my students who walked here alone from Guatemala when he was 13.
Would you say that one more time?
Yeah, he walked here alone from Guatemala when he was 13.
Just hear that, everyone.
And who knows what horrors he experienced along the way, but he is a beautiful human being. He teaches ESL in Alexandria now.
And let's hope they don't send him back.
He's a full citizen now.
That doesn't seem to stop anyone.
I know. He was put into a foster home here, and so has like a sort of an American family. Hopefully, he's fully embedded in American life.
Sounds wonderful.
But this is called Song of the Exiles. There never was a garden, only a leaving. Miles and miles of footprints in the dirt. In the beginning, the shattered sun, the wind, and nothing left but our shadows sifting through the dust behind us. When we turned, we did not turn to salt. When we turned, there was nothing behind us to burn, nothing to return to. Though who could blame us for turning, with only the long days ahead, tongues tripping in the dirt? They said we didn't belong. They blamed us for leaving the garden, which never was or would be. Where could we go? We, who had come from nowhere and hence could not return.
The voice of Holly Karapetkova. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on remote. We are produced by Forest Wood Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Rivada Foundation, Natalie Canavore, Sandy Jackson-Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.